So, you remember your first?
Oh, yeah.
Where was it?
It was at the Indiana State Fair.
The Indiana State Fair.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about my first fried Oreo, right?
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
Welcome back to Junk Food Cinema, now recording live from the future.
Live.
From the future.
The future.
Yes, it is 2015, and movies have told me that that's when the future is. So we're recording from the future, as far as I understand it.
Well, as far as I understand, apparently we would have the Back to the Future, but somebody went back in time and screwed the whole thing up.
Damn it.
Ugh. That's why we don't get to call each other Bojos.
No, I'm forever going to call everyone Bojo. I think that's pretty amazing. This is, of course, Film School Rejects Weekly Cult and Exploitation Film Podcast. I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I am once again joined in this, our second year of Junk Food Cinema, by my friend and co-pilot, novelist slash screenwriter, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
Hey, if you didn't already know it, Junk Food Cinema is available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema and like us on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. Second year, man.
Well, it's our second calendar year. We're coming up, though, on our full year of podcasting.
That's true. That's true.
We are scant weeks away from our first anniversary, which is paper.
Okay. I was like, did you get me anything?
I think that's dead.
So dead paper. I got it. I'll get you someone's death certificate.
I was actually speaking of the fact that paper as a medium was dead, but it works both ways.
It does indeed.
So how are we celebrating the first of the year, my friend?
That's a great question, Cargill. See, we geeks, we love origin stories. I mean, and I think movie geeks most of all. I mean, that we just have an inclination toward, you know, the beginnings of things, the roots of things, going back, much like Marty McFly, and figuring out what those origins are all about. And all this month at Junk Food Cinema, we're taking a look at the first feature films of some of the most acclaimed directors working today. The reason we're doing this is that the first film is typically where even the most accomplished, artful, celebrated filmmakers are more likely to do their most culty, genre-y stuff. And now, admittedly, some of these filmmakers have been dabbling in and dressing up genre their whole career, but in that case, often these early works demonstrate a more experimental, risky period in their career. So either this is the film where they're at their most culty, their most junk food cinema-y, or it's the moment when they're doing something that isn't exactly like what they've been doing their whole career, but in so doing is the most interesting. And this week's director is John McTiernan, and that first film is Nomads.
Oh, hell yes.
Nomads.
You've never run from anything in your life. Run from this.
They are here. They are a nightmare. But they are as real as the terror you feel.
You know, the first film often is that film that, where people make their films before Hollywood's influence has gotten to them and before they start making films for the studios, and they're making it to kind of go, this is who I am, in their announcement. And this film was one hell of an announcement. This is one of those movies where it's just like, hey, everybody, I'm kind of a brilliant director and you should hire me to do all these other movies. And McTiernan turned in a film that just doesn't quite look like any of his other films.
Exactly.
But does showcase just how brilliant a director he is.
And you know, John McTiernan is a legendary action film director between Predator and between Die Hard. This guy made a name for himself in really elevating the art form of creating the action movie. And yet Nomads from 1986 is a supernatural thriller, something we haven't since gotten a lot of from John McTiernan. Nothing off the top of my head that even comes close to what Nomads is. Would we ever see from him again?
It's a quirky, oddball horror thriller. It is not, you know, I ended up watching this for Halloween. This is a movie that's been on my to-watch list for a long time. And it was one of those things that was in, it's been on Netflix forever. It goes on and off constantly. And every Halloween, I'm like, oh, hey, we should watch this. And my wife's like, I don't know. She would read the description and just, she's like, I don't know if that interests me or not. And it's one of those things that kind of, it sounds a little dense when you first read the description. And finally this year, I was just like, you know, you want to watch horror movies every night, but you never want to watch you always want to watch the old stuff that I've seen a million times. You don't want to watch it. Well, we'll name a new movie. And I'm like, Nomads. We haven't seen Nomads. She's like, fine, let's watch it. And then by the end, she's like, why did I put that off for so long? That was so good. It is such a good fucking movie.
Absolutely. And this, the basic plot here is that you have a French anthropologist who has just moved. Played by an Irishman who moves to the United States and realizes that these nomadic tribes that he's been studying all over the world, he's taken something back with him to the United States. Something is pursuing him. And of course, that's the general plot, except the structure of that.
It's not.
And the way that it's told is, I mean, this is one of the things I like most about this movie is that it seems to understand, even at the time, what a conventional supernatural thriller was, and then actively, deliberately fucks with format. Yeah. I mean, the star is Pierce Brosnan.
The star of Remington Steele, Pierce Brosnan, like you've never seen him before.
In his first actual lead role in a film. Now, this is very fitting because last year on Junk Food Cinema, we covered his very first on-screen appearance at all in The Long Good Friday during our Bob Hoskins retrospective. So here he is again in his first leading role as a Frenchman. For some reason.
As a Frenchman. And oddly enough, the character that is functionally the protagonist of the movie, but not
actually
because when the movie opens.
Spoiler alert.
He's dying.
He dies in the first 5 minutes. Like, I'm sorry, I'll probably have to put up a spoiler alert before I say
that. No, because this is literally, you watch the opening of the movie and it's him dying.
Yeah, it's like directed by John McTiernan and Pierce Brosnan's dead. Like, you see the credit, and then he's dead. Like, it's dead that soon.
And then you're following this woman who's now investigating his death and his life. And in doing so, we see his horror story.
Yeah, well, she's investigating it because she is tactily feeling his memories. Like, she is inside his head. There's an exchange between them right before he dies. And she more or less becomes possessed by his memories. And the rest of the film is her kind of walking through where he's been, and more specifically, the last week of his life.
Yeah.
And all the things that transpired in that last week, starting with this bizarre encounter with a gang, like a street gang, and an act of vandalism that seems just like a random act of defiance or whatever, but carries with it a lot of weight, and then we get a lot of the tropes. We get, like, the something bad happened in this house, and we get the, is that thing real or did I imagine it? But the packaging, the way it's presented, is unlike anything I had ever seen before.
Yeah, it's a really weird film that is its own thing. It's the best way to describe this movie is it's fucking cool. It is just a cool fucking movie. It is... Everything about it, from style to structure to performances, everything about this movie works and is of its time in a very special way. I want to start off talking about this. And one of the things I find most interesting about this film is there was a window of about 2 to 3 years in cinema. It was a post-Spielbergian kind of movement in which... after E.T. and Poltergeist, which, you know, one was directed by Spielberg and the other was produced by Spielberg
/ directed by Spielberg
around the corner shooting at the same time on an adjacent street that may or may not have been somewhat directed by Spielberg. But how Spielberg plays with light in that movie really kind of defined a very short-lived movement in cinema, in which, you know, he played around with this very clearly artificial bright light and using fog machines and kind of lighting. You know, there's that famous shot of when they're right before they're playing D&D where we're outside and we see the shaft of light coming out the door. And, you know, it inspired a bunch of people to play around with light like this. And then we saw we saw that bleed into indie films and a lot of stylish directors. And it's this weird, very staged, very cinematic use of light that became very unpopular shortly after. And this movie falls into that. And when this movie plays around with light, it is just really cool looking and at the same time very dated. It's a look that then was stolen by the Italians. And if you look at a lot of the Italian films, especially the Fulci stuff and the Fulci knockoff stuff of the mid to late 80s, you see them kind of continuing to go through this. And that's where that cheesy look came from, was mimicking this look. This movie, I think, does it. Handles it in one of the best ways possible. To use an example, another film that we talked about that had a similar style that was, you know, through the lens of the Italians was Man on Fire, the original Man on Fire.
Ah, right, yeah.
Which played around with style and light the way that you see McTiernan playing around here. And this is exactly the type of thing you'd expect from a first-time filmmaker, which is, here's the new thing. This is this cool, you know, new language in cinema, and I'm going to play around with it. And there's one shot in particular in this movie where he does that. It's, you see these shadows standing in front of trees and the light coming streaming behind it. Mm-hmm. And it just looks so cool and creepy and it's almost, I would call it the iconic shot of this film. But at the same time, you look at it and you go, this shot couldn't exist anywhere else but 1986. Like, after 1986, this wasn't cool anymore. And this was like at the very tail end. But this movie has its own very cool look of this era that when you watch it, it is undescribably from the mid 80s and from the cutting edge mid 80s. And then McTiernan would later go on to help pioneer the next way of doing things. And we'll talk about that later. But yeah, it's just visually, it's such an interesting movie. And then it pairs with that weird structure. Mm-hmm. And there is just something, there is something otherworldly about the entire film.
And you talk about Brian De Palma being the guy who borrows the most from Hitchcock, who is the most clearly inspired by Hitchcock. There are a couple elements of Nomads where I feel like McTiernan is putting his spin on Hitchcock. I mean, from the very idea of having your biggest star in the movie essentially get knocked off in the first act, to having a character who can't resist looking at life through a lens and the curiosity that comes with that, like venturing them into danger. I mean, specifically with Pierce Brosnan's character, I mean, he's an anthropologist, you know, much like Jimmy Stewart's character in Rear Window was a photographer. He can't help but be fascinated by people. He can't help but be curious about people and delving into worlds that he really should be leaving alone. And that's what ends up causing him all this problem, is he realizes that all these nomadic tribes he's been studying around the world, from, you know, African tribes to Inuits to all the, you know, all these other tribes, are very similar to this roving gang of street thugs. Like this very, it's, I mean, it's a gang led by Adam Ant, if that gives you any idea of visually what we're talking about here. You know, this leather clad punk.
Adam Ant of Adam and the Ants.
Yes, there you go. So this leather-clad, you know, just gang of punks that marauds through the neighborhood, he starts to become fascinated with them because, as he puts it in the movie, I followed them for 30 hours and they never stopped moving. There are nomads in major cities. And he becomes fascinated with them. He can't stop following them around. And therein lies that curiosity is what drags him into this sort of supernatural threat. And I think that's really interesting. And again, when you couple that with the idea of knocking off your biggest star in the first act, like that to me is, it says to me that he's borrowing as much from Hitchcock as anybody else. But then, of course, we don't see that kind of thing from McTiernan again in any other movies, which I think is what makes Nomad so special, is that while there are elements that remind us of McTiernan's work to come, there are things that are in this movie, you know, as you talked about, just visually, that we don't really see again from him.
Yeah.
And whether that's a changing of the times or a changing of his personal style, it's really fascinating to note in this movie.
Yeah. And also, since we keep mentioning Brosnan, how brilliant is Brosnan in this movie?
He is really good in this movie because at first you allow yourself to believe that what he's doing is a very standardized, like, stuffy professor performance. And then you see him go through these changes. You see him really start to care about his subject, even from afar. And then you see the madness that he kind of gets dragged into. And then after that, like, there are just so many levels of who this character is as this transformation happens. And really, there are like four different versions of the same guy that he's playing at any given point throughout the movie.
And here's a guy who would later play James Bond, playing a Frenchman, note for note, and doing it in just a fantastic way. Like, it's so weird because Pierce Brosnan is someone that you normally see in movies, and he's one of those Hollywood style actors that he's a star more than an actor for the most part. Yeah. That you hire Pierce Brosnan to get Pierce Brosnan.
You hire Pierce Brosnan to point the camera at Pierce Brosnan, yeah, and let the camera soak up all that is magnificent about Pierce Brosnan.
And then have Pierce Brosnan deliver the lines in the way that Pierce Brosnan does. Yeah. And here instead, you have this performance that is him just deep in this character. Like, it looks like Pierce Brosnan, and it sounds kind of like Pierce Brosnan, but it's not Pierce Brosnan. No. And it is probably his best performance in his career, just in terms of the strength of it and the nuance of it and just the depth of it. Like, you know, we have British actors and Australian actors who can't maintain an American accent for an entire movie, and this guy never breaks the French. Like, no Irish ever slips into that fucking thing.
Yeah. I mean, there is one point, I think his accent works for me, but there is one point where, oddly, he's dubbed. Like, it's a scene where they're standing on top of the World Trade Center, actually, and they're staring off into the distance, and it's a line where you only see the view, and it's clear it was an ADR situation, but somebody else is all of a sudden speaking his line, and it just created this weird juxtaposition. Like, you have an actual French person dubbing this line and then cutting back to Pierce Brosnan. Like, that was the only part in the film where the French accent didn't really ring true, and it's because they had literally just put it side by side with an actual French accent.
Yeah.
I was like, why would you do that? Like, that to me feels like, if there are any missteps, like any like first-time filmmaker errors in the movie, it's like that one little moment. But other than that, this is a really brilliant film, and one that I don't really feel like there's anything else in the movie that makes you go, oh, this is from a first-time director. Mm-hmm. It's very bold. It challenges the idea of everything we've ever seen in a ghost story film before. And I love comparing it up against Poltergeist, which is sort of the sweet, heartfelt, there is an afterlife, and what does that mean? This is more like, the afterlife is a really just fucking lonely, horrible place, and you never want to come across it. Even if it is from an academic perspective, you just want to stay the fuck away from it. Because once you know it exists, it will claim you. It will take you to basically uphold its own secret. Like, that's the whole thing about Pierce Brosnan and what he discovers about this gang, is that, they're not just random street people. Like, these are, in fact, the ghosts, the wandering Inuit spirits that he encountered on his journey that have followed him because they are attracted to places where things have gone wrong, where people have died, and the house he moves into happens to be a place like that. So he's literally being pursued, not really by ghosts, but by trickster demons of the Inuit culture. It's just like, whoa, hold. But like, that's a whole depth, yeah, and layer to a ghost story that we've never seen before.
Yeah, so to put all these, marry all this together to give you an idea of the basic premise of this, is he runs across this group of punks that we talked about earlier, and then slowly discovers that after taking photographs of them for 30 hours, that they don't photograph and they're not real. And that they've known he's been following them around, and they've been luring them in and posing for photos, and they don't exist. And so it starts to become, a question of, is he mad? Is he going nuts? Is he just obsessed with his work? Or did he run across something? And it's clear to anybody watching this movie that he ran across something. And these spirits, it's just a really cool way they develop this, this mythology and the way it evolves, and the way we learn the story through this doctor who is suffering with these memories and trying to get them out of the head. And just that relationship, and that's what's so interesting about it, is there's several layers to this, because we're watching Pierce Brosnan's journey, but we're watching his journey through this this other character, and as she experiences it, and she clearly has part of him inside her.
And which is a strange Vertigo element. So again, I'm just seeing like all this weird Hitchcock porridge to this movie.
But then McTiernan always does interesting things with it. Like, one of my favorite scenes in the movie is the scene when, because she's been reliving this guy's memories, and then he meets this guy's wife. And as a result, there's this weird kind of sexual chemistry to their meeting, because she's been feeling his feelings about her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting and ballsy, especially for the 80s, you know, especially for 30 years ago. This was just like, wow, this is kind of cool, racy stuff in a way that's not overt.
True.
And it never puts it in your face, but it's there. And it's just this movie. Porridge is a really good way to put it, because there's just so much. It's a movie that, if you lay it out, it's one of those movies that you could say, you know, not a lot happens. Structurally, it does not conform perfectly to three-act structure in a way that is satisfying to the audience. It's definitely not a Hollywood movie. And yet at the same time, when you get to the end, so much has actually gone on in the film that you can't say that wasn't about anything. It's kind of about a lot of things.
Yeah.
And it really is one of those films that challenges you with its final shot to put everything together. Because the final shot is really unsurprising. In the history of telegraph shots, you kind of see that coming from 45, 50 minutes out in the film. And yet at the same time, that the way they do that shot and the way it works out puts everything together, and it's a film you sit and you want to reflect on, you want to talk about.
Yeah, and I think just the nature of haunting itself having a deep cultural root, and again, like, we're talking about Inuit culture when you talk about movies that explore the supernatural. And they want to throw ancient cultures into the mix, where they usually go with Babylonian, Sumerian, Egyptian. Like, there are certain go-tos. There are absolutely certain go-to ancient cultures that you use when you construct horror films. This, to my knowledge, is the only horror film I've ever seen that utilizes Inuit culture.
Yeah.
That's really remarkable. And the fact that you can kind of chalk up all hauntings, all ghosts to... It's not even really about ghosts. It's about... You know, these demons from various cultures that are so nomadic that they just wander around. They wander everywhere. And a haunting is really just, this is the place they happen to be right now. And then they're going to move on because they can't stop moving. And they're attracted to death, and they're attracted to mischief, and they're attracted to woe. And I think it's so amazing that if it weren't for the fact that Pierce Brosnan were an anthropologist, this plot would have gone nowhere. Because it's not until he discovers their presence that they're at all interested in him. Because they were interested in the house. They didn't give a shit about the people in the house. They were just, it was like a flame, and they were moths, and they were drawn to it. But as soon as they realize that he is aware of them, their sole occupation for the rest of the movie becomes, we have to take his soul to keep our secret, essentially. Yeah. Like, they don't care about scaring. They don't care about, you know, claiming another for the army. They just don't want to be revealed. They don't want their secret to get out. So as soon as he becomes aware of them, it becomes a race for them to claim his soul, make him one of the nomads, so that no one will know that they exist. And that's so opposite most haunting movies, where it's like the ghost presence, it wants to make its presence felt to freak people out, to send them out of the house, whatever. This is like a very practical, analytical purpose for these ghosts to take this guy. It's like, we don't care about scaring you. We don't care about occupying your house. We just don't want anyone to know we exist.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really interesting turn on
that. It's borrows to a certain extent from Lovecraft, in that Lovecraftian, you know, maintaining the secrets.
You've seen into the other side. You've stared into the abyss, and we have to take you now so that no one else knows about it.
And this is kind of a Lovecraftian story, in that we're watching this guy kind of slowly sink into madness and watching his life unravel as he's like, oh, so close to figuring it out. and he's got them, and then he can't escape them. Yeah. And then he's in too deep, and then it's all about running from the horror, which then leads us into the opening moments of the film.
Yeah. And then, yeah, it's when we track back, you know, we get back to where we started. And that, you know, I want to talk just for a second about the ending that we mentioned. And it's like, yeah, maybe it's a little telegraphed, but there's just something about that stare, you know, as we see the guy on the bike and realize that it is Pierce Brosnan, and you have the nurse telling his wife, like, no matter what you see, just keep driving.
Yeah.
Just keep, because she's figured it out. She understands that as soon as they acknowledge that it's there, it will never leave them alone. So yeah. She's like, no matter what you see, just keep driving. And for the wife to be able to see that her dead husband is sitting right there on a motorcycle and just have to keep going is heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And then of course, that great song by Dave Amato plays, like, right at the end. It's, like, got this creepy coda to it, and it's just... It's perfect. In my opinion, it is the perfect ending. Telegraphed, perhaps, but the absolute perfect ending.
No, that's the thing is that wasn't really a slant against the film. It's just one of those things that you watch and you're like, oh, I see where this is going. But that ride is still really enjoyable, and that ending is perfect. Mm-hmm. And just the way we see Pierce Brosnan sitting on that bike and taking the goggles off. And it's just, it's got so much power to it. And it's, and he looks fucking cool doing it.
Yeah. I mean,
it's really one of those scenes where it's like, well, fuck yeah, he turned into a punk. That's kind of fucking awesome.
Yeah. Which is so funny because all of the original songs in this movie are co-written by Ted Nugent. And when you think about punk artists, you don't really think of Ted Nugent, but the soundtrack by Bill Conti is really interesting to me because it sounds a little bit like Giorgio Moroder.
Yeah.
As I started watching this, I'd never seen it before. That music's playing. I like, with brand new movies, I like to play this game called Guess the Composer. So before the credit actually comes up, I try to figure out, you know, just from the opening music, if it's not a pop song, if it's an original piece, I try to guess who the composer is. And my first guess was Giorgio Moroder. I was like, there's weird pan flutes and like subtle rock strains. I kept seeing like Tony Montana in his office. I was like, that's what this sounds like. And then Bill Conti came up. I was like, oh, well, I was completely wrong. But it's certainly Bill Conti, in my opinion, trying to sound like Giorgio Moroder.
So let's recap. If there was any question that this movie was made in the 80s, it has Adam Ant, songs co-written by Ted Nugent,
right.
Stars Pierce Brosnan, directed by John McTiernan, with a Bill Conti score that sounds like Giorgio Moroder. Does it get more 80s than this fucking movie? And you haven't even seen the shot I'm talking about.
Yeah, and this is also the second screen appearance from legendary singer Josie Cotton. So 80s all over the place.
It is, but not the 80s you think of. It's the cool 80s. It's it was the hip 80s, not the mainstream 80s. Most of what we talk about when we talk about how great the 80s were, we talk about all the big mainstream stuff, even the mainstream flops. You know, The Thing was a big movie that flopped. You know, this is a movie that played at small theaters and played at midnights at drive-in theaters, and nobody fucking saw. And just kind of, but Arnold Schwarzenegger fucking saw it.
Oh, yes, he did. Arnold Schwarzenegger saw it. And it was said in an interview, actually, it was in his memoir, Total Recall. Schwarzenegger said that he was so impressed with the atmosphere of the film and, you know, the atmosphere of this low budget movie that he hired John McTiernan to direct Predator. Now, here's the thing. There is nothing in this movie, in my opinion, that screams out, this guy should be directing Predator. This guy should be directing a sci-fi action movie.
Sci-fi action comedy.
Sci-fi action comedy. Like, three genres that this film is not. And yet, I have to give it to Arnold Schwarzenegger, because if he hadn't had that complete disconnect of a thought, like, this is, that's, to me, that screams Schwarzenegger, like, now he can do Tension. We should have him do Predator. And it's like, that makes no sense. Like, those two things don't go together at all. But had you not had that completely backwards thought, we might not have had John McTiernan. So congratulations.
Well, I think the fact that he really, the movie looks both slick and has those great horror elements. And I think that's probably what Schwarzenegger was pulling, was digging into, was he was really thinking about, you know, I know all these guys who can direct a great action film, but I need one that can make it scary and gets the characters of this movie. And I think that's probably what he was grasping at, because and it was also one of those things that, you know, that happens sometimes. You know, it happens to people who work in Hollywood, where you watch a movie and you're like, holy shit, that guy's talented as fuck. I want to give that guy some money and see what he can do. Mm-hmm. And you know, was he right? I mean, John McTiernan only went on to direct, you know, this little action thing in a building, and then this movie about this alien that was an alien.
No, he was right. I'm not arguing with results here.
Die Hard and Predator and...
Obviously not arguing with history, but I'm just saying that when you look at the movie Nomads...
Hunt for October...
And then you look at a project sitting on the table that's called Predator, about an alien that comes down to hunt mercenaries in the jungle, there's nothing about Nomads that tells you he'd be right for Predator at all. But thankfully, Schwarzenegger, you could call him a visionary, you could say he was insight, or you could say that his roided-up brain just put two things together that didn't need to go there... And
I know this man is Irish, and yet he sounds like a Frenchman. Maybe he can make me sound like an American.
There you go. There you go. Maybe
I became Russian there for a moment. It's amazing. My accents are flawless.
You were Red Heat Schwarzenegger for a second.
I was Red Heat Schwarzenegger. Wow. That's what I was trying to do.
That's like the best Schwarzenegger. I don't know what you're talking about.
Jim Belushi Schwarzenegger, best Schwarzenegger.
So, you know, and again, we have a very conventional... thriller that is turned on its ear by concept and by specific choices with structure. And you have to give credit to McTiernan for that, because in addition to this being his directorial debut, he also wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
So this came entirely from John McTiernan.
It's so good.
And it's really, really good. And I gotta give credit to the imagery in this film, because there's one particular sequence involving an abandoned church.
Oh, yeah.
That really, like, freaked me the hell out. Like, you know, he comes across this place where the punks had been gathering, and Pierce Brosnan stumbles inside running away from them, and there's this nun, and she's like, I can understand why you thought this place is abandoned. It's just me here now. Would you like some tea? And everything is really kind of disconnected and weird. It's very dark in there. And then all of a sudden, he goes by the rooms, and he realizes that there are other people in this church, and there are other nuns occupying these rooms, and they're all doing like these really bizarre things, and it's just it's unsettling, to say the least, as is the shot. And it's during this next shot is during the day, so double props for this, because if you can do creepy during the day, like, that takes talent. There's a shot where they look out the window and all of these punks are just standing around in front of the house that really reminds me of Assault on Precinct 13, where they look out and it's just like this weird collection of dudes just standing there.
Yeah.
But it's during the day, and it's exactly as creepy as that, which, again, I have to tip my hat, because day horror is such a hard thing to pull off.
Well, that's one of the things about this film, is just how, you know, by the monster he creates, you know, with these nomads, they don't play by the rules that we're used to in conventional horror movies. And as a result, you don't know what to make of them. And it's one of the things with experimental horror that really works, is that when it's done right, like it is in Nomads, you just feel unsettled constantly, because you don't even know what the rules are that you're playing by.
Right.
You know, it's not like with Poltergeist, where they're constantly explaining the rules to you, and every time you get to a new thing, it's like, look away from the light, Carol Ann.
Yeah, there is no Rubenstein in this movie.
Yeah, no, there's no Zelda, you know, and it's just the very fact that they stand outside, it's like, the fuck are they doing? Are they going to come in? What the fuck is going on? Are they just to freak me the fuck out? Or are they I don't fucking know. And you don't know the rules. And so you're always unsettled. And the fact that these things are always moving and never stopping, and that set up in the first act, you're just like, I don't know what to make of these things. And it allows him to do some really cool shit.
Absolutely. And I have to give a shout out. One of the members of this gang, who is just called the Singing Lady, is played by Mary Warnov, who you might recognize from any given Roger Corman film. She was one of his she's in Rock and Roll High School. She's in Death Race 2000. She is in Cannonball, like you name it, any Roger Corman movie. If you needed like a tough female character, she was that tough female character. And oddly enough, she was also in Silent Night, Bloody Night, not Silent Night, Deadly Night. But I had to give her a special shout out. But this is
the knockoff of
Silent Night. Well, no, it preceded it. I guess you could say Silent Night, Deadly Night is its knockoff. But here nor there. I love this movie. I love how smart it is. And I love the twist that it takes on convention, and I love the performance of Pierce Brosnan, and I love the score. Like, it was one of those movies I was excited to discover, and it's streaming on Netflix, by the way, so you guys should go check that out immediately. Really fantastic piece of filmmaking. And now we're going to delve into a segment that we're going to have all month long that I've just kind of dubbed Director DNA. And it's like, what about this movie do we look at and kind of notice is something that will come to identify that director later on. And, you know, we're talking about style, and my theory is that a director's style is kind of born out of an initial adherence to one mechanic or another and then blossoms out. Like, there's something that they learn in film school or just through practical application that is one of the tenets, and they latch onto it, and then they do their own thing with it, and that's how we get style. And I think for McTiernan, the thing that he latched onto was camera work. And, you know, I did some research, and one of the signatures of McTiernan's style is that apart from stunt work, he doesn't use multiple cameras. And using multiple cameras is like a standard of the film industry.
In action scene, in action movies.
Yeah. In action movies especially, but he does, even after, you know, and he said, you know, he's admitted that, you know, while shooting Predator, while shooting Die Hard, during the action sequences, he used multiple cameras. But for everything else he's ever done in his career, he only uses one camera. And he says this, this is a great quote. He said, if you don't know where you're going to cut and you're hoping that one of the cameras gets there accidentally, you get a lot of cameras. So his style is to, you know, take one camera, know exactly where he wants the flow of the scenes to go, and just use it that way. He uses camera movement based on character emotion and not just the physical movement of the actors. And I feel like you see that a lot in Nomads. Like, the choice of specific shots, like pulling in at this exact moment or cutting. There's no wasted shot. There's not a wasted edit in the entire movie. And it's every time there is an intense moment, especially with Brosnan, you know, like, every pull into his face is exactly where it needs to be to heighten the tension. And every pull out away from him is, you know, I mean, like, every single movement of that camera benefits the emotional subtext of the scene. It's not just because he's moving here, so the camera has to be here. I mean, there's a first for somebody doing their first film to have that kind of artistry. I mean, he referred to it later as, like, he refers to shots as notes in a piece of music. And I feel like you totally see that in Nomads. You see every shot kind of building up to this crescendo and then paying off so beautifully well.
Well, and what I would also point out is he's very good with structure. He's one of those guys who tells very careful, structured stories until the midpoint of his career. I mean, the thing is about him is his first four films, you want to talk, if you just pull those first four films out, you know, most of you haven't seen Nomads or heard of Nomads. Nomads is the kickoff of four perfect films. What I would argue is perfect films. And then it leads into this midpoint of his career, which isn't that great. And then his final film, which isn't actually his final film because he's going to supposedly direct something else, swings back and I feel is every bit as good and is just underrated and neglected. One of the things that even in his bad films, the structure of them, he knows how to perfectly structure action and revelation of information. Like, the way he gives out information, he gets what an audience wants right away. There's one film in his entire career where he really doesn't feel like he knows what he's doing. And that's Rollerball. Every other film, even the ones that don't work, like Medicine Man, which is really kind of hit or miss with people, you watch it, he knows exactly what the audience wants. Mm-hmm. He knows what they want at every moment, and he gives it to them.
Yeah.
And then he knows what the conventions are, and he goes, oh, hey, you know what would happen in this scene normally? well, this is what's going to happen here now.
Right.
And you end up with, you know, with a guy saying, hey, you know what? I'm sick and tired of watching action movies where the hero walks out after...
Completely unscathed. Yeah.
What would happen if we started out with a white t-shirt that got bloodier and bloodier until the point it was brown at the end of the movie? And you have Die Hard. You know, he did very similar things with Schwarzenegger in Predator the year before. And then he follows up with Hunt for an October, where all of a sudden it's like, hey, let's have a nerdy guy. Let's make an action movie about a nerdy, you know.
About an analyst.
An analyst, a nerdy ex-Marine, you know, going and on this crazy adventure. And you get stuff... you get these sequences in that film where it's like, hey, you know, here's our protagonist. Let's just drop him in the ocean.
Yeah.
By a sub and have everybody freak out about it because he can't survive out there. And, you know, make him completely helpless. Let's showcase that. Like, this is a guy that understands structure and then breaks the rules in all of these movies in all the right ways. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think is so fascinating about him, is he really is one of those guys who knows how to play by the rules just enough to get away with breaking them.
Yes.
And that the way he broke them in his first handful of films is brilliant.
And you know what? I want to take just a moment here. I know this is neither here nor there to what we're discussing, but I want to defend Last Action Hero for a second, because I really like this movie.
That is okay that you like this movie. You are not alone. There are 4 or 5 other dozen people in the world that will defend Last Action Hero.
Look, in order for him to be, you know, by your own admission, to be a guy who's good at breaking the rules, you have to understand what the rules are to know exactly how to break them. And there is nobody, in my opinion, no director that understands the tenets of action cinema, the conventions of action cinema, as well as John McTiernan. And what Last Action Hero does is beautifully send up every single Hollywood action movie convention you've ever seen. And that script, I will argue this till the day I die, is really witty, is really fun, and is really smart. The problem
that
is...
That Shane Black script?
Yes, and the problem is that the person they got... It's a double-edged sword, because you have to put an actor like Schwarzenegger or Stallone in that role in order for the meta quality to come forward, in order for it to be someone who actually does exist as an action hero in their actual career in real life. The problem is that when you get guys like that, especially Schwarzenegger, he doesn't get it. He doesn't get the joke. He's just not quite...
I feel like Schwarzenegger gets the joke.
If you listen to his line delivery, he doesn't get the joke.
I don't think Schwarzenegger has ever been a good actor. I think he's a great action hero, but he does not. I mean, Schwarzenegger's in on the joke, but he seems to ham it up a little too much and miss the point.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. He doesn't get it. He's not there. He doesn't get the point, and that's why that movie fails. That's why the movie has the reputation of being bad.
They also rewrote it, though.
I will argue night and day that it is not a bad movie. It is a movie that suffers from the fact that it has to have a guy like Schwarzenegger playing the lead to work, but Schwarzenegger is not the right guy to make it work.
Now defend Rollerball.
No.
No, the thing is,
I want to, I can't.
Yeah, see, the thing is, I would argue that McTiernan's only made 2 bad movies, and then one... borderline mediocre movie, and that's Medicine Man. There are things to like about Medicine Man. And then I actually really like his late work as well. I know, you know, I feel like he did some very mainstream stuff, you know, because he did Die Hard with a Vengeance, which is really good.
Yes, it is.
And that
movie is breaking his own new rule. Yeah. His own Die Hard rule he breaks in that movie, because the Die Hard rule at that point, in that point in the franchise, was you take the hero, you put him in a small space, very confined, and he has to fight his way out. They took the small space and made it the size of New York City.
Yeah.
It shouldn't work, but it does.
It does. And then in 99, he had 2 good movies. One that I thought was really an interesting failure, because it really never caught on, but I love what they're doing with it, and that's The 13th Warrior, which of course is a realistic retelling of the Beowulf story, adapted by Michael, you know, from a Michael Crichton novel. And then of course he remade The Thomas Crown Affair, and again,
which is fun.
Again, with who?
With Pierce Brosnan.
And it's good. It's a good little remake of the Thomas Crown Affair.
I like it better than the original, sorry.
Some people, you know what? Some people really do. I think it's
I love Steve McQueen, but...
McQueen is great in that, but I think McTiernan's the better action director. And I think he gets those moments better. And then I love his last film before he got into legal trouble. And we'll talk about that in a second. But Basic... I think Basic is a really cool, ballsy little twisty film. The problem with Basic is that it came out, you know, almost 4 years after The Sixth Sense, and big twisty dramas were all the rage. And so what happened at that point in cinema was audiences were going in looking for the twist constantly. People were like, oh, I see this coming a mile off. And several people figured out the twist to Basic.
Everybody becomes Twist Finder General.
Yeah. You know, it led to that great line in Ocean's 12, I think it was. I think it's Ocean's 12, where Bruce Willis shows up. And he's like, you know, $200 million.
Everybody's so smart. How come the movie made $200 million?
Yeah. But yeah, it's very much that kind of movie where, you know, it's got a great twist, and I just really like Basic. I personally rank it in his top five, because Nomads has made its way into the top five now, and of course, you know, best and favorite swap, because I think Die Hard's his best film, but my favorite's Hunt for Red October. I absolutely fucking love Hunt for October. I've seen that movie 100 fucking times.
Which, again, is a rule-breaking movie because it makes your antagonist actually a very likable protagonist. So
yeah, the antagonist is
Russia.
The antagonist is Russia, which is because this is just at the... It was just on the edge. It was still... You were still able to get away with Cold War stuff. Not everybody was, but this film was. But because it was taking place in 1984. So it's okay that we're going back to the Cold War.
Yeah.
Even though the Cold War is technically over. we were fine
Don't
with
worry
it.
About
but
that.
Yeah. But that was what was so great about it was it was that film that came to us at just the right time. The Cold War was officially over. We didn't know what to do with our lifelong enemies. And here's a film about lifelong enemies coming together because we really have so much in common, and it's our politics that divided us, not our souls. And he so captures that so well. Being a big fan of both works at the time, I think McTiernan made a better movie than the book. Like, I like the book a lot.
Hunt for October.
Hunt for October a lot. But I felt like the movie nailed it more. Like, there's some really good moments in the book that, you know, didn't make it into the movie that it would have been like, oh, that would have been. But no, I think the movie really kind of captured the importance of that story.
Yeah.
And the relevance of it better than the book did.
And something else I want to point out, another reason why Nomads might feel like, as we've talked about, there are little things about Nomads that in some form or fashion do come up again later in his career. But one of the reasons that it might feel so different from anything else he ever did, it was the only film he ever wrote. The only screenplay he ever wrote was Nomads. And I'd be interested to know if
that was produced.
That's a good point. I would be interested to see if he does come back, if he could possibly do another movie that he wrote. I would be interested to see what another McTiernan scripted and directed film looks like.
So let's talk about the personal stuff for a second.
Yes.
Because this is you know, what happened to McTiernan? Why was Basic his last movie? And I know people in the industry that know him, and he got very paranoid. And he got very weird, and he ended up getting caught up with that private detective who went down. What was that guy's name?
Anthony Pelicano.
Pelicano.
Yeah.
That's what it was. Yeah, and Anthony Pelicano. But it wasn't he was busted for, he was involved in the wiretapping, and he had his ex-wife or his wife wiretapped.
Yeah.
Something like that. And then he ended up doing some time.
Yeah.
But before then, he was nuts. I know that from personal experience, he was really excited about Rollerball. Rollerball was the big thing. And he turned to a bunch of the internet guys to help push the remake of Rollerball. And I know Harry Knowles was really excited about the remake because Rollerball was one of his favorite unsung, you know, classics. Oh, hey, you know what we haven't done yet? We haven't talked about things we should talk about in the future. Rollerball,
yay,
the original. Ding, ding. that's something we should cover at some point in time. Greatest sports films of sports never made. I don't know. We'll figure something out. But Death Race 2000.
Death Race.
Anyhow, now
basketball.
You just made a month.
There I know we're planning freaking future content. We should probably finish this show first.
And he was really excited about getting people involved, and then it backfired on him because Rollerball was a mess. Like where this guy had in his career always, even in his worst films, had brilliantly structured action. Here's a movie that doesn't make any fucking sense at all. Like, it just doesn't make sense as a film. It doesn't make sense, you know, in the action scenes. You don't really understand the rules of Rollerball in this version of Rollerball. You don't really know where the characters are, like, geographically. Like, none of it makes sense. And it really was a bad film. And the reaction to it turned him, you know, soured him hard. And he got really bitter and paranoid. And I know people who have known him for a long time who just would talk about it, how sad it was watching this friend go from this, you know, this brilliant artist into slowly devolving into becoming this paranoid guy who thinks everyone's out to get him. And so, you know, that guy went to jail and now he's trying to work on something else to come back. And dear God, I hope he does.
I do too.
Because he's so fucking talented. He's one of those guys who just, you know... there are very few guys that have one perfect action film in their resume. This guy has three perfect action films.
True story.
And the rest, that's where you can debate, you know, and it's like, how many of yours I count, you know, of his films, I count six really good fucking movies.
Mm-hmm.
If not more, there's some that fall into the medium, but I can say that there are five films of his that I absolutely unequivocally love. And if you said, hey, you want to sit down and watch this right now, I would say, fuck yes, I do. I have not seen Hunt for October enough times. I've only seen it like 120. So yes, let's go and sit down and watch the 121st time for Hunt for October. He's that kind of a brilliant director. And I really hope that this is one of those periods that gets set aside as that was the quiet time.
Right.
And now he's back doing something really cool.
He needs a reconnaissance. He needs his own reconnaissance.
If you've never been frightened by anything, you will be frightened by Nomads.
Well, we're going to wrap the show up as we usually do, talking about the junk food pairing. And I think we've picked a doozy for this one. It's going to be the Eskimo pie, which, if you're not familiar with the Eskimo pie, it's a vanilla ice cream bar that is chocolate covered. And then wrapped in foil. So it's basically, can't decide between a candy bar and ice cream, boom, here you go. It's the original ice cream candy bar. And I could think of no better way to pay tribute to Inuitok, the Inuit god of mischief that is the antagonist of Nomads, than by, you know,
insulting him with an Eskimo pie.
Devouring this vaguely racist frozen treat. So that's what we're going to do. And, you know, some people, they don't like the taste of Eskimo pies. But
who the fuck doesn't like an Eskimo pie?
I don't know, man. I'm really Inuit. Ayo!
I hate you so fucking much.
I know, it's so great. I feed off your hatred. And now that I know, now that you've acknowledged that hatred exists, I will possess your soul to keep others from finding out about it. Nomad. Well, that's going to do it for the first show of our new series. Thank you so much for joining us.
New series?
Yeah, it's our new series. It's our month-long series.
Yes, it is. I thought we're calling it Series 2. What, are series we really two? Pretentious?
No.
Junk Food Cinema Series 2.
No. Obviously, that would be Serving 2 and not Series 2.
Bam.
But thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I know. Please keep subscribing via iTunes and as well as on Stitcher. You can follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. You can also like us on Facebook, facebook.com/Junk Food Cinema. Cargo, where can people find you online?
You can find me at twitter.com/massandworm, MASSAWYRM, or at facebook.com/massandworm.
Very good. You can also find me on Facebook, facebook.com/ Brian Salisbury Critic, or on Twitter at Bri Guy Salisbury. And please head on over to oneofus.net, my home away from home, for all your geeky podcast and blog needs. And I want to point out again that you can use the Amazon link here on the page to buy Nomads. It is streaming, but if you like it so much you decide you have to own it.
Which you might.
Definitely use our Amazon link to get there, because once you get there via that link, it really doesn't matter what you buy, because we'll benefit from any of it. So thank you very much for doing that. But please come back over the next successive weeks of the month and find out who the other directors are whose first films we will be we'll be discussing. I didn't write anything to go out on this week. Not really sure how to end the show, so I guess we should just
wander off.
I think we're gonna do that.